From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's show, worker safety. More than 400 Californians died from job-related injuries last year. We'll visit one of the most dangerous job sites right next to the highway.
It's like a ballet where the engineers have to choreograph traffic continually in motion while they demolish or construct new elements of our highway system.
Some workplace hazards can't be seen or heard, like cleaning fluids used by janitors or hotel maids.
Workers who've had skin rashes all over their body, they had to take off weeks of work. You know, people who say that their asthma's been irritated to the point where they can no longer work at all. So, you know, these are really severe health consequences that have been proven through our experience.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. We'll get started right after this. And welcome once again to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. This hour, we're talking about workplace safety. Cal/OSHA, the state agency charged with protecting California employees, says more than 400 workers died from injuries related to their jobs last year, and thousands more were injured. That noise you hear in the background is the sound of cars, buses, trucks, and motorcycles making their way through the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge toll plaza. Caltrans workers here and throughout the state's system of highways, tunnels, and bridges face all kinds of potential risks. Since 1924, 174 California Department of Transportation employees have been killed on the job, including two Caltrans workers this year alone. Off in the distance, workers are constructing the new Bay Bridge, and we're here to talk about what it takes to keep them safe on the job. Here with me are Joey Crocker and David Villarreal, field safety specialist for Caltrans here in the Bay Area. Gentlemen, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let me begin by asking you, Joey, what are some of the risks that Caltrans workers here at the Bay Bridge toll plaza over there working on the bridge, what are some of the risks they face on the job?
A lot of the risks that we face are errant motorists and traffic hazards. Our job is inherently dangerous, so we take every precaution we can to keep our employees safe in the field.
And when you say motorists, what do you mean?
You know, with the new communication devices that people use these days, talking on cell phones, things like that.
And here at the toll plaza, people are supposed to be slowing down as they come, although you've got fast track, which means people can zip through at hopefully not more than 20 miles an hour. But does that add an additional kind of risk to the toll takers? David?
Yes, it does. The average speed here, like you said, it was maybe 15 to 20 miles an hour. It's usually 50, 55. So we've had some accidents where they've crashed into the building itself.
So what are the kinds of things you do to protect them from that?
Well, when Joey and I come out to review an operation, we make sure that the advance warning signs are in place to warn the public that we do have employees out here working. We make sure that the closure is up to our policies and procedures, our cone placement. We've put safety vehicles in place to protect them. This way, it gives them a little bit more protection.
So, Joey, you're out here 8 hours a day, presumably, something like that?
Yes.
What kind of near misses do you see?
I've seen quite a few near misses driving down the highway every day, especially during inclement weather, stormy conditions, things like that. We see quite a few near misses in those situations, and we also see vehicles that have slid out or turned over. The unfortunate part is that we work out here on the road, so we have to deal with that on a daily basis.
And what do you guys do? What are you out there sort of surveying the work sites? I mean, what do you do to protect them?
When we pull up on a lot of the job sites, we typically start off by monitoring traffic and seeing what traffic's doing. And then, you know, it falls into place. We'll check out the distance of our signs that we have in the field as far as cone placement, what our sight distance is on our arrow boards or our flashing signs, things like that. And then we'll look at our worker safety. You know, are they wearing the proper personal protective equipment, things of that nature? Are they working in the safest possible manner? And if they're not, we do our best to address the situation at that time.
What about over across the way on the new Bay Bridge span that's being constructed? What are some of the issues there? Joe Kearns?
The current construction project, just like with any construction project in Caltrans, it's like a ballet where the engineers have to choreograph traffic continually in motion while they demolish or construct new elements of our highway system. And it's a major task.
One other issue that comes up for people on the new span or this current bridge as well is you're up high, so there's wind. What role does that play in safety?
Wind is not so much a concern for us. I work in the paint program currently. We're aware of issues with heights regardless of the elements. Wind is a factor. In fact, if you've walked the cable and you're up there, it's somewhat enjoyable to be out there with the elements as you're going about your business. It's just a part of your workplace.
How do you work with Cal OSHA? Like, what's the interface with them? Joey?
We deal a lot with them when it comes to accident investigations or some building inspections, things of that nature.
And they're kind of a watchdog as well. So I'm wondering, to what extent do you collaborate and to what extent do they try to, you know, come unannounced and check out the work site, either here or anywhere else?
Well, they do at times come unannounced, but a lot of times if we have any questions, they are a resource to us. So we do call them up and ask their opinion or their suggestions on maybe how we do something. When we meet with them, not only when there's injuries, well, we do trade back and forth input so they can understand what we're doing and what we're trying to do. At the same time, you know, we try to comply, or actually we do comply with all the regulations to the point where our safety regulations go far beyond what Cal OSHA requires. So we think we have a very good safety program.
Give an example of something that goes beyond what Cal OSHA requires.
We have to notify Cal OSHA when we're doing lead work on some of the older structures where lead-based paint is one of the primers. And so we give them advance notification. But our in-house lead program and the matrix we follow for worker protection does exceed the expectation that's spelled out in Cal OSHA.
And what are, I'm thinking of things that people inhale on the job. I mean, here you've got auto exhaust, truck exhaust. Up there you've got paint fumes. What are some of the precautions you take or they take at the toll plaza there?
We have respiratory protection. The depth of the respirators that you use depends on the area in which you work, whether you're in a confined space, whether you're in the open air. So, again, we have a matrix and a protocol for the use of the personal protective equipment, or PPEs, as we call it.
Maybe just tell us, what are some of the things you do on a typical day that are, you know, have some risk?
Oh, myself, this morning, I had a crew at the Carquinez Bridge. We were craning material over the side, over the railroad in Crockett. We're establishing a platform for a paint project we will be conducting. So, you know, we're working out of a lane closure. You got to be aware of traffic. We're working with moving machinery, pinch points. You can suffer injury, major or minor, so you have to be cautious and conscientious as you move around in a work zone.
These are jobs you can't be daydreaming.
No, definitely not. You got to be heads up all the time.
That's Joseph Kearns, a painting supervisor with Caltrans, along with David Villarreal and Joey Crocker, all of them field safety specialists with Caltrans. They were talking with us near Interstate 80 by the Bay Bridge. And joining us now here in the studio is Kevin Thompson. He's editor of the Cal OSHA Reporter. That's a weekly publication for the occupational safety and health community. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
When it comes to Cal OSHA here in California, do they have a collaborative role typically with companies and industry where they're working together to make the workplace more safe? Or, as I asked the Caltrans guys, do they just sort of show up unannounced and try to be watchdogs?
Well, it's a dual role. They have an enforcement role, and they have to react to situations as they develop. But they work very hard to be collaborative with various industries.
And is there a sense that industry welcomes that kind of collaboration, or is there a resistance?
No, they welcome it. You know, Cal OSHA used to be seen as, the safety cops. But that's sort of evolved over the years. There's a lot of very progressive industry associations, and they don't see them as the enemy anymore. They want to work with them because they know it's not productive to always resist.
So it's in their interest as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Talking about those kinds of jobs that are more dangerous, more hazardous, I think also of agriculture jobs. And looking at the statistics mm-hmm. in California, you do see a number of the deaths coming from people working on farm equipment. But mm-hmm. a lot of injuries, I would think, among, say, farm workers.
Yeah, it's considered a high-hazard industry.
And also the working conditions, such as heat. Mm-hmm. And to what extent has the state taken a different approach toward that kind of workplace problem in the past few years?
Well, California is a leader in the country on heat illness regulation. It's it adopted the first heat illness regulation in the country. Cal OSHA has played a very aggressive role in doing sweeps on farms to try and enforce its message.
And I think the governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, just recently enacted, signed into law some new regulations, and I think those were among the first, if not the only, in the country.
Right. Well, that was in 2005 and 2006, and more recently, Cal OSHA has moved to amend the heat illness regulation to strengthen it. But there's been some pushback from construction because they feel that it's really an agriculture problem and that they're already complying. So, you know, why should they be cast under the net of more regulation?
To what extent are the people who tend to work in these higher risk occupations, do they tend to be lower income, low wage? In the case of farm workers, many of them undocumented, not union members, and therefore perhaps, you know, more vulnerable.
That's all pretty much true, although a lot of them come under UFW, the United Farm Workers. You know, Cal OSHA faces a kind of a dual problem there. You've got some employers who, frankly, exploit workers, but you also have workers who come from a culture where safety is not ingrained. In fact, getting the job done is the priority, and safety comes way after that.
Give an example. You're talking about, you know, for example, people coming from south of the border?
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's a more of a macho culture, very hard workers who want to provide for their family. And in some cases, you have employers who, farm labor contractors, for instance, who, you know, don't really want to pay attention to safety. They want to get the job done, and that can lead to tragic results.
Give us a sense of how good a job you think Cal OSHA is doing in California.
I think they do a very good job in several areas, and of course there's always challenges and things they could be doing better. But the strengths that I see are that they're able to respond to events and hazards that come up and develop regulations a lot more quickly than the feds can ever do. California is the first and, well, one of the only to require that all employers have an injury and illness prevention program. That's almost 20 years now that that's been in place. The only state, and feds don't have this either, to have an ergonomics regulation. Heat illness, of course, bloodborne pathogens. It was the first state to protect healthcare workers from needle sticks. The state has worked harder to regulate the adult film industry.
Why is it that it's so much easier in California to get those changes?
There's political will in a lot of cases, for instance, heat illness. This conversation got started in about the year 2000, and there was a lot of employer resistance to it. And then workers started dying in 2005, I think it was.
Really 12 bad or 13, heat wave that year.
Right. Awful heat wave. 13 workers died, I believe it was. That created the political will. Bloodborne pathogens was another, you know, the AIDS epidemic really hit hard here. You know, it started affecting healthcare workers, so there was a political will to change that.
What do you see as the trend in California in terms of workplace injuries and deaths? Are things getting better?
They are. Both injuries and illnesses and fatalities have dropped each year for about the past 10 years. But the trend that I see that's disturbing is that increasingly you find more Hispanic surnames and or Latino surnames among injured and dead workers. So that's a real problem. And I'm not sure that's a Cal OSHA problem. I think it's a societal problem.
What do you attribute it to?
Well,
the kinds of jobs they're in.
The kinds of, you know, they're working in highly hazardous industries. A lot of times they're undocumented. And as we spoke about before, you know, the safety culture hasn't become a part of their ethic.
One of the biggest criticisms, though, and this was highlighted in a recent LA Times article, is of the Cal OSHA Appeals Board, which, of course, businesses, industry that is faced with a fine, they can appeal that ruling. And the article stated that the Appeals Board regularly reduces industry fines by measures of 10 or more. I mean, they sometimes settle for pennies on the dollar. What's your thought about that? Is that a problem with the power of industry or the lack of political will? What is it?
Well, a lot of this goes back to a law that was enacted in 1999, AB 1127, which tripled the fines for serious injuries and fatalities. Well, what this led to was a flood of appeals, naturally. And by 2004 or so, the appeals board, which was shorthanded, was faced with a backlog of about 4,000 appeals. So at the same time, Fed OSHA, which oversees the California program, ordered them to reduce the backlog and the amount of time that it took to resolve appeals. So they were in emergency mode. Frankly, you know, I've seen some of these cases where fatality cases where fines were dismissed.
On technicalities.
That kind of gets to, you know, your sense of justice.
Now, in California, most industry operates above board, but some of it is below the radar. You've got sort of black market industries. Right. And just recently, I think Cal/OSHA fined a number of car washes for unsafe working conditions. And I think a lot of them were not – didn't have proper licenses and so on. To what extent do you think that's a problem where you have businesses, anything from the marijuana industry to something that's perhaps not inherently illegal, but you know, just operating below the radar?
It's a big problem, and the state recognizes this. They have a program called the Economic and Employment Enforcement Coalition, of which Cal/OSHA is a part, and then the Division of Workers' Compensation, Employment Development. They target specific industries. Car washes is one, restaurants, garment, agriculture and construction, and they do multi-agency sweeps. And the whole point is to root out what they call the underground economy.
And how successful is it?
They have been doing this for several years now, and they have handed out millions of dollars in proposed penalties. I don't know what the final disposition was, but I think they're getting the message out.
The states are not required to have their own statewide OSHA, but they're allowed to. And I, California, about half the states do. I think 26 states have it. Do you have a sense of, you know, how does California's compare with other states?
I think Cal/OSHA is regarded as one of the top safety programs in the country.
All right. Well, Kevin Thompson is the editor of Cal/OSHA Reporter. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When you think of dangerous jobs, occupations like construction worker or firefighter may come to mind, but not all workplace risks are so obvious. In fact, some jobs that might seem safe aren't necessarily risk-free. For instance, take green jobs, like workers hired to weatherize old homes or install rooftop solar panels. As Sarah Varney reports, new jobs in the clean tech sector come with their own hazards.
The pricey enclave of Piedmont, California, is an island of green in the Oakland Hills. Driveways are filled with Priuses. Roofs are topped with sparkling solar panels. And everyone, it seems, is cleaning out their attic.
As you can see, the insulation is moving out to the 6-inch hose and going to a bag, a special bag designed for removing insulation.
Devere Bracca, a co-owner of Advanced Home Energy, stands next to a truck filled with what look like enormous brown bean bags. Hoses snake out of the truck, down a small path, and up into the windows of a home that's in the midst of a green cleanse. Two men in white Tyvek suits, booties, goggles, and respirators disappeared a few minutes ago into the attic. And now, decades worth of dust, insulation, nails, even mice droppings are being sucked out.
Unfortunately, this is a messy job. This is a hard job that sometimes we need to crawl into attic spaces.
The job will take 2 days, Bracca says. After all the old insulation is sucked out, his workers will seal the attic and pump in new insulation made from recycled blue jeans. Of course, weatherizing homes isn't new, nor are the hazards workers face. Mike Wilson is a research scientist and executive director of the UC Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry.
These are dirty jobs. They are often conducted in confined spaces with high levels of dust and in many cases using adhesive materials that are used to insulate ducting and water piping and so forth that are volatile, that contain toxic substances.
State regulations mandate special procedures for removing asbestos, lead, and hazardous waste, but the vast majority of toxic substances have not been evaluated for what's called a permissible exposure limit, the amount a worker can be exposed to for 8 hours without posing a serious risk. Workplace exposures have devastating consequences. 60,000 Americans die each year from workplace-related diseases. California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health is charged with protecting workers, but the agency, starved for resources, has just 200 field compliance officers to enforce regulations for 17.5 million workers.
Like any new industrial sector, there will be employers who take advantage of people, and with a weak compliance system in the state, it's almost certain that that's going to occur.
One of the most dangerous green jobs is solar installation. That's because falls are the number one cause of work-related fatalities. Workers carrying heavy panels on pitched, slippery roofs have died falling off buildings and through skylights. Earlier this year, one solar installer was electrocuted after a long bracket hit a high-voltage power line. Working on roofs doesn't require any special certification. Solar companies generally train their workers to install their own proprietary systems. Workers are supposed to wear harnesses and other protective gear, says Sue Catley, executive director of CalSEA, a solar company trade association.
I've had constant problems with people telling me that construction workers don't like wearing harnesses on the roofs because it's not manly. And I'm saying, well, you know, wear them anyway. It's almost you feel like it's working with people when they first had to learn how to put their kids in child seats.
We're trying to get rid of that attitude, the macho, oh, I don't have to put gloves on to do this. I'll just do it like this. Or I don't need to put my respirator on because I can smell okay. I'm not breathing improperly.
That attitude is changing as younger construction workers attend green job training programs that are proliferating around the country. At the Cypress Mandela training program in West Oakland, director Sylvester Hodges says his students, most of whom are poor African Americans and Latinos, learn not just about carpentry and solar installation, but also about the threat of climate change and the values that started the Green Revolution in the first place, like reduce, reuse, and recycle. Still, there's a long way to go. Even greener materials, like the recycled blue jeans used to insulate attics, are sprayed with flame retardants. Though there are some less toxic flame retardants, the most commonly used accumulate in everything from human breast milk to shellfish. UC Berkeley's Mike Wilson says that shouldn't stop people from greening their homes.
There is just this critical need for us to respond to climate disruption. And yet, we also face this problem that we've faced so many times of unintended consequences. And we can do things now to avoid those.
Like finding alternatives to toxic chemicals. And, says Wilson, state and federal agencies should more aggressively regulate chemicals in consumer and industrial products. And he says despite severe budget problems, governments need to invest heavily in their enforcement programs to ensure workers are being protected. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
And now we hear from a Salvadoran day laborer about the workplace hazards he runs into. He asked that we use only his first name, Gustavo, because he has no papers to work here legally. Reporter Julieta Kuznir produced this postcard.
Well, I'm from El Salvador. My name is Gonzalo. I got family down there, you know. I've been here for long, you know, more than 30 years now. I fell down, but, you know, I'm still alive. Oh, the way I connect with people to get jobs, you know, I like a... I advertise myself, you know, screaming, yelling on the street. Hey, labor for hire, you know, we do movers, you know, we do painting, concrete, you know. Sometimes people, they are interested in something to do back at their home. You know, like one day, this employer from outside that came, you know, I got him on the street, you know. He took me to work. In the place, they had to clean a dirty place. They had syringes, you know, those old things, smelly, false smell, you know. And he didn't provide us with gloves, masks, nothing safety. Just that, you know, when we saw that he was paying us $10 an hour, when we started, but at the end, we decided with another guy, you know, to keep going. And we asked for more money. He said, no, I cannot give you more money. $10 an hour, you like it or not? Take it or not, it's up to you. The wind decided, was get somebody else. We came back here, you know, because it's, I know it's unhealthy doing that thing. You know, we can put ourselves, get, you know, get any kind of illness. You know, we say, no, we cannot do that. Then we quit. But most of the time, I don't quit the job. It doesn't matter how hard, how difficult the job is. We just try to perform what we're getting paid. You know, I don't complain about that. Because where I come from, you know, people, older people, 70 years old people, 75 years old people, 68 years people, they keep working. They keep working, hard labor, you know, and they don't complain. They just work, you know. I'm still struggling, but I live in a shelter, but that's the only way I can feed my family.
That audio postcard was produced by Julieta Kuznir. To comment on anything you hear on Health Dialogues, send us an email. Our address is hd@kqed.org. Again, that's HD, as in Health Dialogues, hd@kqed.org. Coming up in the second half of our show, the chief of Cal/OSHA joins us, along with a legal watchdog who often does battle with his agency. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
The winter holidays can be a time to reflect on our lives, a season to appreciate family, friendship, and good health. It's also a time to wish for health and happiness for the coming year. Join us in December as Health Dialogues shares stories of how health and illness have changed people's lives, how it's brought pain, sorrow, and sometimes even hope. You can learn more about Health Dialogues at our website, healthdialogues.org.
And welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. This hour, we're talking about workplace safety, risks of injury, illness, even death on the job. And we're joined now by the man who runs the state agency that oversees these issues. Len Welsh is chief of Cal/OSHA. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Also with us, an adversary of sorts, Fran Schreiberg. She's an attorney with WorkSafe. That's a nonprofit organization providing legal services and other support services to activists working to improve workplace safety and health. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Let's begin, if we can, Len Welsh, with a little bit of news having to do with the food flavoring industry here in California, specifically the use of a chemical called diacetyl, which is used in butter flavoring for popcorn, among many other food flavors. And we know that diacetyl has been found to cause respiratory problems in factories where it's used. And Cal/OSHA is getting closer to implementing some kind of rules and regulations. Why don't you tell us about that issue and where you're at with that?
Well, as you said, diacetyl is a butter flavoring. It's an artificial butter flavoring that's widely used in the food industry. There are about 27 flavor manufacturers in the state. And over the last 3 years or so, our work with them has revealed about 7 cases of workers coming down with a very debilitating disease called bronchiolitis obliterans. It's pretty much not reversible. Several folks who've been diagnosed with that disease are on lung transplant lists. It's a very serious thing. We've been working with those companies for the last 2 years. They've agreed to have us come in and give them advice about how to control exposure. We haven't seen any new cases, as far as I know. And our work has gotten us a certain amount of data on exposures that workers encounter when they work with this substance. And we have a rulemaking proposal that is about to go to hearing. This is a product of about a year and a half's work with all interested stakeholders, labor and management, to come up with the first standard in the nation that will limit exposure to diacetyl for workers who work in the food manufacturing and flavor manufacturing industries.
And what would the rule do? What would the change be?
It would require employers, if they're working with materials that have diacetyl in them at 1% or higher, to limit exposure both through engineering controls and what we call personal protective equipment. In addition, they would have to screen employees with pulmonary function tests to determine whether they're showing any adverse reaction to exposure. Employers would have to provide training. And also, if somebody gets sick, they would have to provide what we call medical removal protection benefits.
And are there any other states in the nation that have any kind of a rule, or this is strictly a California-only kind of regulation?
So far, as far as I know, it's a California-only regulation, although I know Federal OSHA is now making serious moves toward trying to adopt a standard of its own.
Now, it sounds like you've been collecting data for about a year and a half, but this is a health risk that's been known for some time. Is that not true? People have alleged that they've gotten sick.
Indications of problems with this substance go back to the last 3 decades of the 90s, actually. The only concerted studies that I know of that really have been definitive have been done by NIOSH, starting...
NIOSH being the
National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. It's not an OSHA regulatory agency. It's a research agency, part of the Centers for Disease Control. And they began a series of serious studies at the turn of the century, about the year 2000, and produced some very well-known work now about exposures in the popcorn manufacturing industry. So a lot of those data are part of this rulemaking record.
So, Fran Schreiber, as you listen to this, and I know you're very familiar with this issue, do you see this as an example of Cal OSHA at its best, or is it an example in some way of what's wrong with the system?
I think it's an example of both. It's Cal OSHA at its best because it is, in fact, moving forward with regulation for a toxic chemical that no other state and, in fact, the federal OSHA folks have not done. And that's true in terms of a number of chemicals that Cal OSHA has addressed over the years. At its worst, it's an example of the kind of delay and a kind of political approach to rulemaking. And it's Cal OSHA is not an entity that is just Len Welsh. It is an entity that includes a standards board that's an independent board. Len's group does research and standards development on health issues, and they propose things to the standards board, and the standards board makes its own decision, and it's very influenced by politics. And Len's group actually oftentimes will, and I think in the diacetyl reg you have an example of it, two of the trigger mechanisms for when this regulation will go into effect are, as Len mentioned, a 1% diacetyl concentration by weight. And then there's another one where they're determining, well, gee, if you have something called fixed obstructive lung disease, that'll also trigger the regulation. But both of those triggers tend to eliminate people from coverage of the regulation. So
If you have less than that, you're not covered, you mean?
Well, if you don't have a fixed obstructive lung disease or if you don't have 1% of diacetyl in the flavoring, then you're not covered by the regulation. The regulation is a good regulation, but if it doesn't cover very many people, and part of the reason it doesn't cover it is because the flavoring industry got sued by people who were getting sick. As manufacturers, they could be sued instead of being covered by workers' comp. And so they went ahead and took care of part of this problem in the last period of time. But going back to kind of what the political part of this is that the standards board itself is made up of political appointees. They don't really have a lot of inherent expertise, and yet they are the people that are supposed to apply an expert opinion. And oftentimes the agency that prepares this regulation, Len's agency, defers to that, and they reach the lowest common denominator in terms of consensus. And so they know that if they propose 1%, if they propose fixed obstructive lung disease, they're less likely to have complaints by the industry, and then the reg will go through. But if it goes through and nobody's covered, it's not, or a few people are covered, it's not a great regulation.
Yeah. I want to move beyond diacetyl, but before we do, Len Welsh's reaction to what she's saying. Is it true that this was sort of a compromise standard that you thought would, you know, meet less resistance or even get buy-in from the industry?
All standards are compromise standards, as we can see from everything from the healthcare debate to toxins and foods, you name it. There's always an element of compromise. Once 1% is what we have proposed now, that's based in large part on what the data show. Just about all the cases we know of, I think every single one of them came from environments where the percentages of diacetyl in the materials they were working with were far in excess of 1%. I'd like to see it go down much lower than that, and we'll see what the comments bring at the hearing this week. But we do have to get the votes. And that's basically what it boils down to in this state. We have to get votes.
Taking a step back, Len Welsh, do you think of Cal OSHA as being an agency that is proactive and really going out and setting standards in advance of problems and trying to head off problems before they happen? Or is it more driven by complaints and reacting to things that have happened in the workplace?
Well, obviously, we want to be as proactive as we can. And one thing I would like to point out with this, Fran mentioned coverage being, you know, not so many workers or something along those lines. In fact,
For the diacetyl,
that may well be true. But the fact that we're proposing this level of 1% has already driven industries across the nation to try to cut down on their levels of diacetyl.
What was it before that, typically?
I think in those NIOSH studies, there were levels as high as 35%. And it was quite common to see levels above 10. So we were already in a very different ballgame. Some companies continue to use higher levels, and they're willing to do the engineering controls. But for the most part, companies are trying to get out of that. They want to get below 1% or whatever the cutoff percent is. And if that's the effect of the reg, to sort of drive industries into a realm where they don't have to comply with it, and we've protected workers that way, that's just as good as having actual coverage under a reg.
And my response to that is that what has happened is that groups of folks who work in the food manufacturing as opposed to flavor manufacturing business. So the people who work in big bakeries and so forth, popcorn manufacturing, chips, potato chips and so forth that use these flavors, they're not going to be covered because, as Len said, yes, they've driven this down to under 1%. But we're also not going to get medical surveillance of these people. We're not going to find out whether or not these people are having these early signs of lung disease because there's not going to be coverage and there's not going to be any way of keeping track of these people. And as Len, I think, would agree with me, many of the doctors who see these folks confuse what it is that they have. They think maybe it's asthma. They think maybe it's something else. This is not such an easy thing for the doctors to understand, and that's why, in fact, the reg has wonderful medical surveillance criteria and instructions for these doctors, but in the food manufacturing business, they're not even going to get to that point because nobody's going to be surveilled.
Hmm. There was a time back in the Duke Majan administration that Cal OSHA was eliminated altogether, 1986, 87. He blue-penciled the funding.
Yes.
And I think even perhaps you were there back then.
I sure was.
Yeah. So it which does point again to this idea that the whole idea of protecting the workplace is it's subject to politics and budget cuts. And, of course, we're in a very dire time right now in California with regard to the state budget. How is it affecting your agency, those budget cuts?
Well, the furloughs are tough. We have 15% less time to do the work that we're supposed to do. The statutory mandates don't say we can do 15% less compliance with them, so it's tough. So we have to prioritize the inspection work we do.
How do you prioritize it?
Well, when it comes to inspections, we want to go after the highest hazard environments that are coming to us because we figure that's the way we save the most lives.
And do you tend to focus on particular kinds of workplaces or industries?
Well, over the last several years, we've been making a real push to essentially get at the underground economy, where you see the greatest amount of noncompliance, not only with health and safety laws, which is about every other law.
So, for example, what kinds of businesses? Are we talking about car washes?
Car washes. We've been in agriculture quite a bit. That's been in the news quite a bit with heat illness prevention requirements. If we know that crops, for example, are being harvested at different times during the year, and we know what areas are being harvested, we can send what we call sweep teams there at the beginning of the day, and we can catch them in the act. We can see how they're doing. In fact, we shut down about 13 employers this past summer with that kind of approach when we found workers out above 90 degrees working without shade.
Now, my understanding is that for the entire state, Cal OSHA has about 200 inspectors for somewhat 18 million workers in the state. Fran, does that even begin to approach what you would need?
No. And if you look at the job that Cal OSHA is doing in terms of enforcement with these limited resources, they're doing, I think, possibly the best they can. But the reality is that they should have more resources, and particularly in standard setting, they need more resources. They need doctors. They need epidemiologists. They need toxicologists in order to do a good job. They also need, by the way, to rely on material that comes from, say, Cal EPA, where chemicals have been reviewed already, and to not reinvent the wheel. I think that a lot of the problem that is going on in the standard setting process is that things are just done over and over again that have already been done. But coming back to the enforcement aspect, one of the things that I think is important is to try to have an approach to health and safety that looks at having workers have a chance to actually impact what's going on there. In my own experience, I worked actually at Cal OSHA for 4 years, and I did the criminal prosecutions, and I read every single fatality that came through for a period of 2 years. And I would say in 99% of those cases, somebody ahead of time knew that that so-called accident was going to happen, and either they spoke up and were told to shut up, or they didn't say anything because they knew that they were going to either put their job at risk or something. So I think that what we need to do is we need to have strong standards, and then we need to have health and safety reps or committees to allow workers, every one of them, to be a safety inspector, not just wait for Cal OSHA to come around once in every 180 years, which is possibly how long it would take to do every work site in California with the statistics that you threw out.
And Len Walsh, what kind of protection is there for workers who come forward? I mean, if it's a union shop, perhaps there's a little bit more protection. But in many cases, these are probably service industries, not just manufacturing, where perhaps people are undocumented or just at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, and they're less powerful. How do you encourage them to come forward? Or is that not your job?
It is our job to encourage them. It's partially our job to protect them. There's another agency that helps us do that. But I'm certainly not going to sit here and claim that a worker can step forward and feel like he or she can complain about an unhealth or unsafety condition with impunity. I mean, it's a constant problem for us. When we go to hearings, we often need employees to step up and testify, and they simply don't want to risk their jobs to do that.
I want to ask you about a part of this whole process, and that is the appeals board, the Cal OSHA appeals board. Of course, businesses that are fined can't appeal. And the LA Times recently reviewed that whole process and found that the board repeatedly reduced or even dismissed some of the penalties that were initially levied by OSHA. And the allegation, the implication is that the system is really skewed toward business. And Len Welsh, what's your reaction to that?
I don't think I can characterize the system as being skewed toward business. I think the system is skewed toward functioning. My criticism of the board is that it's just too bureaucratic. I think there could be much stronger management of the ALJs who issue the first-line decisions. Administrative law judges. There's a three-member board. Those are also political appointees. And the way this, the appeal system basically works is we issue the citation. The employer can appeal it if they choose to. If they choose to appeal it, we have to go to a hearing and prove up each violation we allege. We have to put the witnesses on, prove the existence of the violations. An administrative law judge hears that evidence and renders a decision. There has been a tendency over the year for a lot of what I'll call hyper-technicality. For example, a lot of folks have already heard of this case where a worker fell to his death on the Golden Gate Bridge, having what we allege to be improper fall protection. We never got to get a litigation of that issue because the judge threw the case out because we had not exactly rendered the name of the employer on the citation.
And Len Welsh, I want to ask you about a specific case that was cited by that LA Times article looking at the appeals board, the case of the Bimbo Bakeries, where a worker lost part of her arm after getting caught in a bread machine. Cal OSHA fined the company $21,750, and it was reduced to nothing. The fine was reduced to nothing. And since that injury, I think another five people have lost fingers or parts of fingers at these various Bimbo Bakery factories. And it just makes you wonder, like, who's mining the store? There clearly seems to be more need for enforcement or protection or a modification of the process. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes and no. I mean, there's always more need. In every walk of government, you can say there's more need for better.
But that's not an excuse to do nothing.
I don't think we're doing nothing. I don't think we're coming close to doing nothing. Bimbo Bakeries is an extreme example of an employer who has just not figured out how to get it right.
Do you think, Fran Shrubber, that the system, the way it is, and even if the Bimbo is an exception, does it encourage other industries, other companies to try to game the system?
I think that most companies don't take Cal OSHA all that seriously. I think that the penalties overall that are set by this agency compared to, say, a penalty for an environmental crime are minimal.
All right. Fran Schreiberg of WorkSafe, Len Welsh, chief of Cal OSHA, thank you both very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
For more information on Cal OSHA, head to our website at healthdialogues.org. You'll find some interactive graphs we made based on Cal OSHA data showing workplace deaths in California. You can look at fatalities by job, industry, cause of death, location, and gender. It's all at healthdialogues.org. We've been hearing this hour about workplace safety and how Cal OSHA's rules sometimes aren't enough to protect workers. Some workers and their unions are taking matters into their own hands, and they were out in force recently in front of a Safeway supermarket in San Francisco.
Tenemos miedo.
No.
¿Qué queremos?
Justicia.
¿Cuándo?
Ahora.
What do we want?
Contract.
When do we want it?
Now.
About 30 janitors carried signs and chanted demands in the supermarket parking lot as police, private security guards, and company managers kept a wary eye on them. The workers are members of the Service Employees International Union Local 1877, and they're here to complain about the health effects of the industrial cleaning products they use in the supermarkets. Rachel Hennekins is an SEIU spokeswoman.
There's a young man, only 19 years old, who gets a nosebleed each and every time he uses the floor stripper. We've also heard, you know, workers who've had skin rashes all over their body. They had to take off weeks of work. You know, people who say that their asthma's been irritated to the point where they can no longer work at all. So, you know, these are really severe health consequences that have been proven through our experience that the janitors who use these chemicals on a daily basis face.
Henneken says the problems often result in sick time off from work. One of the protesters here is 33-year-old Marta Aragon. For the past 3 years, she's worked cleaning a Safeway in Roseville, near Sacramento. Aragon described her experience with chemicals used to maintain the floors.
Bueno, en cuestiones de la reacción al uso de esos químicos.
My personal experience from using these chemicals is that I get a skin allergy and my eyes tear up. When I inhale or breathe in the chemicals, a strong fluid comes out of my nose, and I feel it directly in my throat.
These janitors are not employed by Safeway or the other supermarkets where they clean. They work for a subcontractor that provides cleaning services, a company called ABM Janitorial, based in Houston, Texas. Aragon claims ABM doesn't provide adequate training for janitors or protective equipment like gloves and goggles. Ironically, when we asked the union what they use to clean their own offices, they admitted to using the same conventional products they're here protesting today. ABM declined to be recorded for this story, but they did release a statement. The company claims to meet all state and local safety standards and that it does in fact provide personal protective equipment like gloves, and it offers monthly safety information sessions in Spanish and English. Nonetheless, SEIU organizer Denise Solis is pressing ABM Janitorial for changes.
We're asking them to provide better training, to provide safety equipment for the janitors while they're working, and to look into other options of cleaning chemicals. We're talking green clean chemicals that are not only good for the health and safety of the people working, but also for the environment and also for the people that come to the grocery stores.
This protest comes as the union negotiates a new contract with ABM, and it's designed, of course, to pressure the company into making concessions on wages, benefits, and working conditions. But that doesn't invalidate their claims, says Debbie Raffel, Toxics Reduction Program Manager in San Francisco's Department of the Environment.
There's no doubt that there's a daily exposure in their lives. Could we prove the harm it would take? No. Are they legal to use? Yes. So given that they're legal, given that we cannot prove harm, the answer is precautionary. We ask the question, are they necessary? And the answer is no.
San Francisco has taken this precautionary approach, requiring city agencies to use green alternatives to harsh industrial products for cleaning city buildings.
There is no reason that industrial chemicals cannot be made with human health and the environment in mind. And this is something we have discovered loud and clear in the city of San Francisco. Sometimes substituting an aggressive chemical out of a product means that you don't clean with a nice soft rag, you clean with a scrubby sponge. And so the aggressiveness gets transferred from the chemical to the physical.
Raffel says the new green products policy in San Francisco has had some unexpected benefits.
There was a big fear at first that if you admit as a supervisor or an employer that you may have given your employee something toxic, that you're going to be subject to all sorts of lawsuits and complaints, even when you try and do the right thing and change it out. We have found the opposite to be true, that when we sit down with people and say we care about your health, we have a concern, work with us to find safer alternatives. In fact, that trust leads to better morale and less complaining.
Raffel says San Francisco isn't the only city in California to adopt green products policies, and that often one of the first products governments focus on is janitorial supplies. And for photos of the janitors' protest at the Safeway in San Francisco, go to our website, healthdialogues.org. Some of the most dangerous jobs involve getting behind the wheel of a car, truck, tractor, or a taxi. In fact, taxi drivers face a number of dangers while they're at work, from passengers and from other drivers on the road. Reporter Erica Kelly visited with some drivers and dispatchers from Citywide Taxi Dispatch in San Francisco and filed this postcard.
This is Citywide Dispatch, KRO 357. Time here is 6:10 p.m. My name's Greg Goebel, and my job here is phone answerer and dispatcher. It's almost every week we have a mayday. Usually it's a fair dispute, and it's just because the customer doesn't want to pay or doesn't have the money. About 6 months ago, we had a lady in a cab. She had a Mayday cook that she picked up in a cook's uniform and everything, cook's pants, checkered pants, in North Beach. Took her up to Nob Hill, and he held a butcher knife, a butcher cleaver to her throat and took her money. She didn't even get a chance to call a Mayday during that time, but he got picked up 2 incidents later. It was the same MO, a cook with a butcher. It's pretty easy to spot that. He got caught, and he's doing 6 years in the penitentiary. And 690, you said you're clear?
10-4, I'm clear.
All righty, 1339, 219
Brennan. Second at Brennan.
Could you introduce yourself?
Josh Pryor, badge number 25078. And big dog driver, Gates and Gas Man. Been driving a taxi cab since 1977. As far as health goes and danger, the most dangerous aspect of driving a taxi cab by far are drunk drivers. That means other guys in cars are far, far more dangerous than any passenger problems you might have, because there are much more of them. You've got to go through intersections, through green lights, blind intersections all night long, hundreds of them. Each one of those potentially is deadly. I didn't even see him. It was like intersection, like bang, all of a sudden this guy hit me going, I don't know, 60 miles an hour out of nowhere. Tore off the front end of my cab, spun it around several times, stacked up with 3 or 4 other cars. When I kind of came to, everything was smoking. It's a temptation to have aggressive drivers get under your skin, but you have to, you know, you have to resist that. Back in the days when we were driving these old beat-up jalopy cabs, it was really a temptation just to, you know, to be aggressive and like, yeah, you wanna bump into this thing, go right ahead, you know, I don't care, you know, you and your fancy car, you know, to have a piece of this, you know. You just have to let it, you know, roll off you. It's a conscious thing that you just have to do, and slow drivers sometimes just drive you crazy. I mean, you'd get stuck behind 2 or 3 slow drivers, and it can really get under your skin, or people that just are driving too fast. So you just have to use these little psychological tricks to keep yourself from getting too concerned about momentary stuff. But that's one of the good things about cab driving, is at the end of the night, at the end of your shift, you don't take it with you. You leave your job, you go home, you don't worry about it. It's therapeutic in a sense, because you sort of have a pulse of the city. You kind of feel like you've been out there, you know what's going on, and you don't worry about it.
Bye.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us this hour. And don't forget, everything you just heard and much more is available on our website. It's healthdialogues.org. You can listen to our show, subscribe to the podcast, even suggest your own topic ideas. And of course, you can also get involved in the conversation. That's healthdialogues.org. Tune in next month for a holiday season edition of Health Dialogues. We'll hear stories of how health and sickness can affect our lives. How the fear of death or the sorrow of disease can sometimes bring hope, inspiration, even personal revelations. That's next month on Health Dialogues. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The Health Dialogues team includes Polly Stryker, Susie Rocho, Gabriel Cohen, Nick Vidinsky, Erica Kelly, and Shuka Kalantari. We also had editing help from Dan Brecky. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.